Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. In a moment, I'll talk with Sarah McQuaid with the Columbus Regional Airport Authority. Courtesy of 10TV, Scott Light talks with folks in Chillicothe about what the pandemic has done to the economy there. He also talks with the head of the Health Policy Institute, Ohio, and finishes with a tribute to Annie Glynn. And Daniel Barnett talks with Gene Sperling, author and former assistant to the president for economic policy under Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. First up on Columbus Perspective, joining me on the phone is Sarah McQuaid. She's the communications and media relations manager for the Columbus Regional Airport Authority. How are you?
Hi, Dave. I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for talking to us. First, tell me in a nutshell what the Columbus Regional Airport Authority is.
So the Columbus Regional Airport Authority oversees three airports in Columbus. Most people are probably familiar with John Glenn Columbus International Airport, which is a passenger airport. We also oversee general aviation-based Bolton Field and cargo-based Rickenbacker International Airport.
Okay. Obviously, these days with the pandemic going on, air travel has taken about as big a hit as any business that has remained open. What is going on with the airports in Columbus in that regard?
Yeah, Dave. So obviously there have been a lot of travel restrictions in place since the pandemic hit. And that has really impacted our numbers here locally. We've seen passenger traffic down to, at our lowest point, around 400 people departing from CMH. And that was back in April. We're actually slowly starting to see those numbers rise as people are starting to feel more comfortable with traveling and travel restrictions are starting to be lifted. So obviously Ohio's travel restrictions were recently lifted. Because of that, we've actually seen numbers go up a little higher, and we're seeing about four times as many passengers as our lowest point in April. Today, we actually had 1,600 people departing from CMH, but that's still about 90% fewer passengers than we had this time last year, which is consistent with national trends. Normally, this time of year, we would have over 10,000 people departing from CMH, so it's definitely a big difference.
What about Rickenbacker? Are their flights, they're mostly vacation-type destinations that they fly to and from. Is there activity out there?
Passenger flights departing from Rickenbacker. That is also starting to pick up. But what we've seen that's been really interesting with this pandemic is that Rickenbacker has really had a chance to shine and really show that that airport is a national asset. So we've actually been connecting with our cargo operations, connecting the healthcare industry with critically needed medical supplies, PPE. We've even had some FEMA relief supply shipments come through Rickenbacker.
And this happened during a time when especially John Glenn Columbus International was really on the move with a lot more additional flights to places like San Francisco, and with Alaska Airlines also connecting. A lot of good stuff was happening.
Yeah, definitely. And we're continuing to see people being interested in traveling for leisure or business. And so we're hopeful that people are going to start returning to air travel. It's a really convenient way to travel. And as long as, you know, our passengers are taking the proper precautions when they come through the airport, it really is safe and healthy in our airports right now with our new cleaning measures and things like that we have in place.
Talking with Sarah McQuaid, she's the Communications and Media Relations Manager for the Columbus Regional Airport Authority. So let's talk about Port Columbus, John Glenn Columbus International. When folks do go back out there, I guess things will be quite a bit different as far as procedures in getting around the airport.
Yeah, so really coming to the airport will be a lot like going into any business or a grocery store, as far as practicing social distancing, wearing a face covering, those kinds of things. So when you first come through John Glenn, one of the first things that you might notice is all of our employees are now required to wear face coverings. Our customers are strongly encouraged to wear face coverings, so it's not a requirement, but it is required by most, if not all, of the airlines. So So we really encourage passengers to check with their airline before coming to the airport because you might need to bring a face covering with you. And the TSA checkpoint process is also going to be improved with some new safety measures. And I would suggest listeners check out the TSA website to get a full list. But one of the things that they're now doing is rather than handing your boarding pass to the TSA agent, you will place it on the screening device yourself so that that reduces contact.
Okay. And also, even just getting into the airport out in the parking lot, the shuttle buses have changed, right?
Yeah, definitely. So once you park and get on the shuttle bus has limited seating capacity. So we actually have some of the seats are closed off so that people are keeping that 6 foot social distance. And we have a plexiglass barrier in place separating the driver from the passengers. And there's hand sanitizer right when you get onto the shuttle bus. And really everywhere throughout our airports, you're going to be seeing lots of hand sanitizer. And we're really just trying to make sure that people are practicing those guidelines set forth by the CDC so that we're constantly sanitizing our hands. But in the airports themselves, you know, our custodial staff is constantly cleaning and disinfecting surfaces and high-touch areas as well.
So during the busier times at the airport, when it starts to ramp up especially, if there's still social distancing on the buses, are you going to be running more shuttle buses?
We will definitely be looking into that, depending on how our demand increases. Right now, we actually still have some of our parking lots closed. So as I mentioned, you know, our passenger numbers are down quite a bit, but it's going to be a learning curve, I think, for all of us as we start to see people returning to travel and just returning to getting back to their normal lives. I think that we're going to continue assessing everything as we go.
What about the restaurants and other businesses within the airport? Are any of them open right now and or starting to reopen? And do they have measures in place as well?
Yeah, so obviously the governor's office allowed restaurants to open recently. And so we actually have seen some of our restaurants in the airports reopen as our passenger demand has gradually started to increase. So Charlie's Philly Steaks at CMH is open, Donato's is open, the McDonald's on International Gateway is opening on Monday. And so we're slowly starting to see some of these restaurants start to come online. Aviation Cafe at Rickenbacker is also open, and all of these different dining options are going to have varying hours depending on demand. So we just really suggest that everyone checks our website, flycolumbus.com, before you head out to your flight so you can be prepared.
Talking with Sarah McQuaid, Communications and Media Relations Manager for the Columbus Regional Airport Authority. What about the responsibility of passengers when they come into the airport? Are you checking temperatures or are any of the airlines doing that sort of thing?
We are not checking temperatures, but we do ask that passengers really do that themselves before heading out the door to head to the airport. Do not travel if you have a cough or fever. That's a huge one. And just be prepared by bringing your face covering. Make sure that you're prepared to stay 6 feet away from others. Cover your mouth when sneezing or coughing. All of those CDC guidelines that I think people are already doing a great job of practicing and being just very cognizant of. Washing your hands, using hand sanitizer. But specifically regarding the airport, there are some things that you can do to reduce contact and physical touching. So you can bring a mobile boarding pass, and that way you're just using your own phone and scanning that to get on your flight. You can use mobile payments for parking exits at our airports if you're parking with us. And we actually have touchless parking entry coming soon so that you can just wave your hand over the unit to dispense your parking entry ticket. So there's some things that people can do to kind of mentally prepare for that next trip, because it is going to be a little different.
One of the big projects that was underway was creating a new area for rental cars. Is that still on track?
Yes, our new Conrack parking garage is under construction now, and we expect that to open in 2021.
Well, we just got past Memorial Day, and I don't think anybody was expecting a lot of travel for this holiday, but the 4th of July and Labor Day are still coming, and it would make sense that travel is going to begin to ramp up. But people are still kind of leery of that, I guess, and I would guess that the airport understands that.
Absolutely. Summer is here, and travel restrictions are starting to be lifted across the country. And I think a lot of us are feeling ready to leave our homes and get away after we've kind of been trapped at home for a while. And a lot of people also had trips that they had to cancel, summer vacations, or maybe even vacations later in the fall. But we also realize that some people won't feel comfortable with traveling for some time. And we just want everyone to know that whatever your comfort level, we're ready when you are. And we have all of these health and safety measures in place, so that people can feel confident the next time they come through our airport.
Okay, and Sarah, do you have a website then where folks can review the changes that have been made there?
Definitely. I would go to flycolumbus.com for all of this information.
Okay, Sarah McQuaid, Communications and Media Relations Manager for the Columbus Regional Airport Authority. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Dave, for having me. Really appreciate it.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan, courtesy of 10 TV. Here is Scott Light from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. Here's Scott.
Another new phase to reopening our state, and a reminder to us all to stay vigilant about COVID-19 protection. Governor DeWine lifted what was left of orders to stay at home to now what are called recommendations. But just because Ohio's reopening, some small businesses aren't. We're going to show you the impact in one central Ohio city. I talked to Democrat Joyce Beatty about the next stimulus package idea and talked to a leading health expert about her nonpartisan research on the effects of COVID-19 right here in Ohio. It is already a leading killer in our state. Then we're going to sign off today with a tribute to an Ohio icon, a woman Governor DeWine called our most beloved Ohioan. But let's begin this morning with reopening Ohio and a grim reality. Some small businesses especially won't get that chance. Case in point, this story from our Glenn McIntyre.
Sue Shetterly and her business partner moved their antique shop to the heart of downtown Chillicothe for a reason.
Because this is where the action is. Everybody comes down on paint, you know. Everybody wants to be on paint.
The Paint Street Business District has undergone a small town renaissance in recent years.
All the time there's a new store coming in.
Then came COVID.
It's hurt a lot of people. 2 months, everybody had to shut down.
And some businesses here, including the restaurant next door, aren't coming back.
You can't afford to pay the bills and the utilities, all that, and the rent, you know, if you don't have any business coming in.
Because we have no income. There's just no income.
Brandon Smith is the CEO of the Sciota Society, the nonprofit behind the outdoor drama Tecumseh.
An outdoor drama that tells the life of the Shawnee leader Tecumseh. And we've been doing it since 1973. We've done close to 4 million people over those years. It's the biggest tourist attraction in the area.
Really?
And really redefined what tourism is in southern Ohio.
A cast and crew of 100 people should be working here right now. But for the first time in 48 years, the show won't go on.
In losing the show and everything that goes along with that, you know, that's... close to $1.5 million in ticket sales, retail, you know, food and beverage, all of that stuff.
That led to the decision to close their downtown shop, Tecumseh Trading Company, and lay off a dozen employees.
In the short term, we're cutting everything down so that we can simply concentrate on getting Tecumseh back on the stage in 2021. It's tough. The people who work here, none of us make a great deal of money. We do it because we love it. We do it because we think it's an important story to tell.
While Smith looks to next year, Sue just hopes to survive this one.
We're happy that we can reopen, you know. We just hope we don't have to shut down again. I don't know whether we can get through another second.
Glenn McIntyre, 10 TV News.
Getting more money to small businesses, to state and local governments, that's all part of the next stimulus that's being talked about in Washington, D.C. In fact, the Democratic House has already passed it. Last week, I talked to Republican Steve Stivers, who said this bill is 1,800 pages. No one has read the whole thing, and it was rushed through. This week, I asked Democrat Joyce Beatty about that. Is this too big and too rushed?
Absolutely not, because I look at it this way. We allocated $2 trillion on a very bipartisan vote. And that was because the nation was in crisis. Here's what we learned after that. The nation was still in crisis because we did not do enough. We did not go far enough. For not only the small businesses and not-for-profits, we didn't do it for families, we didn't do it for state and local government, we didn't do it for healthcare and hospitals. So the next package that came along, the package we just voted on, we actually had more of a process for us to be engaged in and to hear about it. So I think it depends on how engaged you want it to be. I received all the information I asked for. I had my team dividing the bill up into sections to go through. Our healthcare individuals read healthcare. I read small business, and then my team came together and we switched the pages that we read. I went on the House floor and had an opportunity to talk about it so constituents would know what's in it. Now, there will never be a perfect bill, but what we know is there were too many small businesses who did not have the opportunity to even be in the hopper to get the funds. We learned that from the banks. We learned that from the Small Business Administration. We learned that from the hospitals. And we have an incredible healthcare partnership here with all of our hospitals coming together, with Abbott being here, with Cardinal Health. So many wonderful things that we have been able to do, but yet, we also know we needed more testing. We also know that everybody doesn't know their primary physician and wouldn't know how to walk into one of our wonderful hospitals and get that free test. So we now have them in our communities. Why? Because in the first funding cycle, we put monies in for community health centers. Millions of dollars came right back here into my district for it. This time we were looking at the whole issue of housing and the homeless. We know that's a problem because of the numbers. It's factual. We know it because of the disparities. We know that people who were in prisons, people who were in nursing homes, people who were in shelters were high in the numbers of testing positively for the virus. So we wrapped all of that up and decided that we would take a look at doing what we should do to help save this nation.
Republican Steve Stivers.
It has a bunch of unrelated topics in it that have nothing to do with stimulating the economy and getting people back to work. And worse yet, of the $3 trillion, $1.2 trillion actually is inducements for people not to go back to work. And that's exactly the opposite of what we need to do as we're starting to open up the economy. We need to figure out how to get people back to work and help them. An example of what's in this bill that's unrelated is a $10,000 grant to everybody that has student loans to help forgive part of their student loans from the federal government. Well, in the CARES Act, we've already passed up to $10,000 tax-free from their employer that they can get to help pay down student loan. And frankly, I want to do everything we can to incent people to take those jobs back and get back to work, because the best thing we can do for people long term is get them back in their jobs and working and get this economy moving again.
So that debate on the next stimulus will certainly continue. There's also still so much more we need to learn about COVID-19, about this virus and this pandemic. So next, we're going to talk to a healthcare expert who has three big takeaways after studying this outbreak right here in Ohio.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors. Back to Scott Light, courtesy of 10TV.
Welcome back. We talk to politicians on all sides, but we also like to bring in experts who study policy in nonpartisan ways, with data and with information. I talked with Amy Rowling McGee this week. She is the president of the Health Policy Institute of Ohio. She's had a long career studying health policy, health insurance, and information technology. The HPIO put out a study on COVID-19 right here in our state. They had three main takeaways: a big and sudden impact of it, the risks certainly remain high, and the need for more data.
Where we compared the deaths of Ohioans with COVID-19 so far this year to the leading causes of death in 2018, we found that COVID-19 related deaths have already surpassed the number of motor vehicle deaths for all of 2018. Wow. And could soon overtake suicide. It's looking likely that COVID-19 will cause more deaths than many other leading causes in 2020. This gave us a sense of scale and comparison. When we look at that few week time period, we weigh our COVID-19 related deaths were way surpassed flu and influenza. We've heard quite frequently that this is more serious than flu. I think those numbers, the analysis we conducted demonstrates that. This virus will continue to spread. As businesses reopen and as we all start to have more interactions with one another, it seems very possible that the number of cases will increase over time. Hospitalizations will again increase over time, and deaths will continue to increase as they have been. We haven't had any days yet since the beginning of this pandemic and the reporting of people with confirmed cases of COVID-19 where we've had no deaths. We also know that we're going to need to continue to take actions, both at the policy level and personally, based on the best available research evidence. I've heard Dr. Acton also repeatedly say there's a lot we don't know about this virus, and that is absolutely the case. And we also know that we're learning new things every day, like literally every day, more information comes out about this virus. What you hear today may be different than what you hear 2 weeks from now in terms of the best available advice, recommendations, in terms of ways that we can protect ourselves and protect others as well.
Your background is interesting. You've worked private sector, public sector, Medicaid, health policy, health insurance, the work you did with clinics. Mm-hmm. What has surprised you maybe about our vulnerability when it comes to reacting to a pandemic?
What first came to mind in terms of what has surprised me is how well we've all come together to take the steps we've needed to take to mitigate the impact of this virus. It's been amazing that predominantly Ohioans have paid attention to the leaders in our state, and we've paid attention to the research evidence. That I have found very encouraging, especially as someone who works in an organization today that is focused on independent and nonpartisan research and analysis with the purpose of informing state health policy.
If you had that healthcare magic wand and you could fix one thing in the American healthcare system in or out or during a pandemic, what would it be?
Data. Mm. I'm going to go back to data. Again, we need accurate, transparent, publicly available data that will enable action. There are other countries that do this better than us and have been able to use that data quite effectively during this pandemic. There are even other states that do this better than Ohio does. You know, without that kind of data, it makes it much more challenging to nimbly respond in an emergency situation like the one we're in right now. It also makes it more difficult to address other health issues as well.
Speaking of how the response to COVID-19 will look going forward, if you haven't heard this already, you will. Two words, contact tracing. That is the next phase as more states open, being able to literally trace the steps of people infected with this virus. Here's the issue, though. Well, people. Some experts say our country needs 100,000 or more contact tracers.
Absolutely. And I know that our state is in the process of hiring those positions. They're hiring people to be contact tracers so that when someone does receive a diagnosis of having the virus that causes COVID-19, then there can be follow-up with all of the contacts that that person has had in order to hopefully convince those people to quarantine themselves for a number of days and prevent the further spread of the virus through the community. So that, coupled with testing and more widespread testing, both in terms of the kind of testing we do to determine whether somebody has the virus right now, and the kind of testing that you may have read about quite a lot lately, the antibody testing, mm-hmm. that can indicate whether you may have had exposure to the virus previously. The testing coupled with contact tracing and all of the follow-up that entails are definitely critical next steps with monitoring and controlling the spread of the virus.
In this final segment of Scotlight's Face the State, he features comments from Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, a Democrat from Columbus, also Republican Governor Mike DeWine, and Dale Butlin, who was a former speechwriter and chief of staff for U.S. Senator John Glenn, all of them reflecting on the life of Annie Glenn. By the way, a memorial service will be held online for Annie Glenn on Saturday, June 6th, from the Broad Street Presbyterian Church in downtown Columbus.
We lost a legend. We are going to end this Sunday morning with the passing of an Ohio legend. Annie Glenn was a wife, mother, grandmother, accomplished musician, and an absolute champion for people with speech disorders. She was also married to an American hero, John Glenn. I talked to several people over the past several days who knew Annie Glenn and loved her.
I tend to want to look at all of the memories I had with Annie and with John and with them together and the time we spent. And she would always do like this, come over here and let me tell you something or ask you something. John made up a word and it was livacy. And because people talk about legacy. Mm. And he said he always wanted to talk about the life that Annie and he lived. So it was more about livacy. And so I use that to say, while we are sad, and certainly my prayers and thoughts go to her children and the family, but she lived 100 years young. She was a courageous woman. She jumped over so many hurdles in her personal life with stuttering, and what an amazing story. But she was also the legend behind John Glenn. So many stories she would share about John either flying or being on the Senate floor or just in their wonderful home here in Columbus.
Annie Glenn was certainly the most beloved Ohioan. And I think we can say that there wouldn't have been a John Glenn, at least as we knew him, without Annie Glenn. The two were inseparable. The two were real partners. And theirs is truly an inspiring love story. She represented all that is good in Ohio, all that is good in this country.
Most people know Annie as John's wife. But the truth is, she was an enormously accomplished individual in her own right. She was a gifted musician who turned down a scholarship to Juilliard, you know, the famous music school in New York, to marry her childhood sweetheart. She also overcame a childhood stutter, which was debilitating, and did that with such success that she was ultimately able not only to give speeches on her own, but also to become a champion for others with speech impediments or other disabilities. She was an incredibly warm person. In fact, in many ways, I think Annie Glenn was the best politician in the family. I remember very well going to different events, for example, black churches. When you'd go on the campaign trail and you go into a black church and, you know, the choir would be singing and Annie would be swaying with the music and singing along and clapping. John was acting more like the stiff white guy that he was. So I think Annie in many ways was the best politician, or at least the most natural politician in the family. John and Annie Glenn belonged to a earlier and more innocent age. When we trusted our institutions, when we thought government could accomplish big and important things, when we still believed politics could be a noble profession, and we could all cheer for the same national heroes, which helps explain, I think, why we feel the loss of John and Annie Glenn so deeply. She was such a contrast to her husband, and by that I mean it was that he was a hero and he had that aura about him. Whereas Annie didn't have that hero aura, and I think she met people where they were in many senses. And so I think she, as I say, was just a naturally warm person. She was genuinely interested in people that she met and what their lives were like and their families, and she'd ask questions about it. So. You know, in that sense, I think they were almost a perfect pair, and they had a relationship, Scott, that was amazing to see. I mean, they literally never dated anyone else. Hmm. They were childhood sweethearts who met literally when they were toddlers. Their parents were friends in New Concord, which is just east of Zanesville, small town. And, they, grew up together. They never dated anyone, as I said, other than one another. And their 73-year marriage was, I think, a love story for the ages. And it was, for those of us who knew and loved them, you really literally could not think of one without also thinking of the other, because they were inseparable. They were always together. And I've reflected on the fact that during World War II, during the war in Korea, and during two flights into outer space, Annie would patiently wait for John to come home. And since December of 2016, it's been patiently waiting for his Annie. And today, I know that they are where they always wanted to be, together, side by side.
Again, courtesy of 10TV. Dale Butland, former speechwriter and chief of staff for U.S. Senator John Glenn, talking about Annie Glenn, who just passed away recently at the age of 100. This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan.
there seems to be a constant back and forth between keeping safe in a time of COVID-19 and having a prosperous economy. A lot of people seem to think those things are mutually exclusive. Governor Mike DeWine has gone on the record to say that he thinks those two things can go hand in hand. And today I'm speaking with somebody else who also believes that you can have a healthy workforce and a healthy economy. I have on the line Gene Sperling. Gene was the director of the National Economic Council under both President Barack Obama and President Bill Clinton. He's the author of several books, including his latest called Economic Dignity, that talk about the ways in which we can have a healthy economy and healthy workforce. He also founded the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution. Gene, thank you so much for joining me today on Columbus Perspective.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now more than ever, of course, there is this stark contrast brought to light about taking care of people and taking care of the economy. And oftentimes they're put out there as sort of a mutually exclusive options. One of the things that you and I are going to talk about today is your new book, Economic Dignity, and that concept. So can you start by explaining to our lay people, our listeners out there, what economic dignity means and what the sort of tenets of it are?
Well, sure. Thank you for having me. You know, I wrote this book after being in the West Wing of the White House for 12 years in two different administrations and being part of economic policy. I just felt that people lose their way if they just start looking at a metric like GDP as if it's our end goal. Of course, it's important for economics, but it's ultimately judged by how well it's helping to lift all people up. And I wanted to write something that said, I wanted to write a different type of economic book that said, what is your aspiration for economic policies and what matters most, which is how well we lift up each other people. And I define that as economic dignity, that should be our end goal, and that it really comes down to three basic pillars. One, are you able economically to care for your family and be there for life's most precious moments? Two, do you have the capacity to pursue your potential, purpose, and meaning? And do you have first and second chances to do so? And third, and this is essential, are you able to work and contribute with respect and without domination and humiliation? And so those are the three pillars. And so I think when you're judging how well is an economy doing, how well are we doing for the people we're trying to serve, the ultimate end goal isn't a stock market metric. It's not a GDP metric. It is how well are you providing or enabling people to work, raise their family, and retire with economic dignity.
Well, and I'm hesitant to ask you for a metric, but I'm sure that in your mind there is a sort of baseline that we should be accomplishing when it comes to economic dignity. What would that baseline be, and where do we fall, I'm assuming your position is that we fall far below that?
Well, we have huge holes is what I would say. I think, you know, many of us are fortunate, but I think the reason why you have a broader definition of economic dignity is not that metrics are not important, but if you just look at one, you can miss the degree economy is failing people. So, for example, you could have an economy where unemployment gets low because, you know, everybody has some form of a job, but if those jobs are all part-time and people are making near the minimum wage, they can't support their family, then in that case, that metric, which is important to have low unemployment, might not be telling the story of whether you're succeeding or not. That's why you need to have a higher aspiration or more important goal like economic dignity. So, of course, let's look at caring for family. This is so relevant today. One of the things I quote in the book is Martin Luther King in 1968 when he says, all work has dignity. He also says that someday our nation will realize that the sanitation worker is as essential as the physician to our health and well-being. Well, today's that moment, right? I mean, today's that moment where we look out and realize, boy, we are as dependent on that nursing aide helping a family member who's got COVID or somebody, a farm worker or somebody who's helping to care for us, deliver for us. And yet, as we have that recognition that there is value and contribution and dignity in the work that so many people are doing. So many of them are making $10, $12 an hour. So many of them don't have a day of paid sick leave that they could care for their own child. When you look at things like this, you can say that a person being able to actually raise your own family in economic dignity, maybe it's not metrics, but you know that that means having a living wage that has health care, that you can take time off if you had a sick family member, even if your job is to care for other people's children or other people's loved ones. So I would say there are components, and I think we all know them. I think it's not even that political. People, the belief in America that if you work hard, if you're doing your share, if you're busting your butt, you should have a degree of economic security, a capacity to give your children a chance to have opportunity, and that that shouldn't require you having to be without rights or feeling abused or harassed or violated when you're at work. And I think all of those things should be part of our vision of economic dignity. And when I see people like, for example, in the meat processing, you know, being pushed back to work with crowded, where it's dangerous, where there's getting high rates of COVID, you see, if you just did a metric, you'd say, well, they're working, or here's what their wage is. But if you look deeper at a broader economic dignity goal, you'd realize that's not dignified to force people to work in unsafe conditions, that it is in a sense treating them not with intrinsic human value, but as if they're only a means to the end of supplying food. And I don't think it's that hard or radical. I think it's something that really fits most American values to believe that those who work, who serve us, who have value, are treated with that sense of value and have not just a particular metric or wage, as important as that is, but the types of protections at work, the respect at work, the capacity to help their children get a step ahead or at least have a shot at getting a step ahead. That's what it means, that when you, if someone's on their economic, on their deathbed and they're thinking about their economic life, it's those things. We're able to take care of your family, provide them a chance up, be treated with respect as opposed to humiliation. These are the things that would matter most. And therefore, that's what should matter most to our elected leaders and to our economic policymakers.
This pandemic happening when it has, you know, we were already talking about things like healthcare for all, universal basic income, raising the minimum wage to, you know, the number is often $15 per hour. Those were already discussions we were having before a pandemic hit. And now those topics, as well as things like paid sick leave, paid childcare, are all economic issues that are being highlighted by the pandemic. So my question is, for those who might not have been on board with those concepts before a pandemic, do you think this changes anything? Do you think that this has furthered some of those causes? Or using your sort of economic crystal ball, do we go back to the way things were when this is all over?
Well, I think it's an extremely important question. And it is my hope that this is a bit of moment of realization. I hate to repeat the Martin Luther King line, but I think that sense that we're each worker is essential and valuable may have felt like more of a spiritual type of a statement, beautiful, but not really applicable in your lives. I think that there's something about this crisis that has led people to really deeply, in a powerful and poignant way, really feel the value and dignity of all work. And so I think it's forcing people to deal with the dissonance that so many of the jobs that they rely on, so many of the workers they rely on for us to live, that we say are essential, that we give people applause, that we call them heroes, that doesn't quite fit with how they're treated, that there's something more powerfully wrong about seeing a person putting their life on the line for us, taking a higher risk of getting COVID for us, and then not being able to even be sure they can pay the rent or take time off to care for their child. Yes, I think it's a powerful moment. And you're seeing it in the applause, you're seeing it in calling essential workers heroes. But a lot of people are realizing, wow, I'm calling that worker essential, but we treat that worker terribly. We do very little. They have no rights. They can be retaliated against if they object. And I think that dissonance is powerful. And if I can quote King one more time, he says in that same speech, what good is it to win the right to sit at an integrated lunch counter if you don't have enough money to buy a meal for your family? And to some degree, the applause is nice, right? But if a person's out there putting their life on the line for family after family, and they come home and they have to say, hey, you know, we have to do without in life's basics, or it's possible, you know, we might be evicted from our apartment or our home, that person, I think, is not going to feel the applause. They're not going to feel that sense of economic dignity. And that's why it's a compact. We ask for people to do their part, to carry their share of the load. But there's, but I think it is a deeper American value that if you do, you should be able to live with a degree of dignity. Have we seen some improvements? Yes, in the unemployment insurance, which often didn't cover tens of millions of workers. Now it's trying to cover everyone, including gig workers, including people who are contracting. That's an improvement. There has been an expansion of paid sick leave, but probably only to about 50% of people. So the question is, will this be like soldiers where you, you know, praise them when they're serving us, but once the war is over, you go back and maybe treat them poorly, pay African-American soldiers coming home after World War One or World War Two? Or does it become a moment where we say, hey, it's not a radical laundry list of progressive things to make sure people can raise their family with dignity? In fact, this is what Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president, was calling for 108 years ago, that everyone who works and does their part, they may not be rich, they may not have the biggest house or the biggest car, but they can provide in the things that matter most to their family and have that sense of dignity and pride and security that they're taking care of their loved ones, that their loved ones have a chance for a better tomorrow, and that the work that that makes that happen doesn't come at the expense of them having to accept abuse and humiliation and domination at work, which unfortunately there are millions of work people do feel is the price they have to pay for putting food on the table.
Once again, I'm on the line with Gene Sperling. He was the chief economic advisor to President Obama and President Clinton, and author of a new book called Economic Dignity. Let's look at both the economic part and the dignity part through those, both of those lenses when I ask, what are the pros and the cons of some of these universal programs that are being talked about? Because obviously there are both. So both from an economic and a dignity standpoint, can you look at those, the pros and the cons?
Right. So, you know, my view is that, you know, I don't support, for example, or propose in my book, universal basic income. And the reason why is what's universal about that is that everybody is going to get a couple of thousand a month, whether regardless of circumstances, regardless of whether they were whether they needed it, regardless if their income's too high, regardless of whether they're wealthy, regardless of whether they're making their best effort to contribute. And it's a huge amount of money, and it just goes automatically to everybody. My vision of economic dignity is more that we are there for each other when we need it to live with economic dignity. So if you look at the crisis right now, you know, we don't, you know, even right now, as terrible things are, probably, you know, 60% of Americans are doing fine. They have their jobs, they're working. I don't think we as a country have to spend huge amounts of money giving a universal check to everybody. What we need to do is say that that there should be universal economic dignity for everyone. So when there's a small business owner or a worker who is seeing their entire economic livelihood being put at risk for a pandemic that is not their fault, then yes, we should have the major unemployment insurance check, or we should have the major help to keep that, let that small business keep the lights on and keep their payroll, workers on their payroll. That's kind of bold that's kind of bold economic policy, but it's not just, we don't just spread it to everyone and spend trillions of dollars we don't need to. We ensure that you that a moment of hardship, that a moment of bad luck, that being in the wrong place at the wrong time, whether it was the financial crisis of 2008 or the pandemic of 2020, doesn't mean you lose everything in life. So for me, the universal is, let's make sure everybody is has I guess maybe you might think of it as a broader, less of a safety net, but a dignity net, something that allows people to always be able to provide for their family when they need it most. And when they don't need it, they understand that that might go to somebody else who's in the wrong industry or the wrong town at the wrong time in the next recession. That's my idea. You can say it's a floor, but it's a higher floor, of economic security that is there to catch all of us. Because what costs people a lot of their economic dignity is not often just that their wage is a little low, but that in the United States, when people face a hard time, the fall is too hard. And that's what happened in the financial crisis, too. Lots of people recovered, but a lot of people lost their house. They lost their health. They often ended up losing their spouse, their family. They had long-term unemployment. And so we allow momentary hardship to turn into a life-altering economic devastation, and we don't have to. That's a policy choice. So that's the that to me is the type of economic dignity we need. Universal economic dignity, but it doesn't mean that every program has to be universal in that it's the same for everyone every year, regardless of your need or well-being.
So give me, let's pivot to our current economic state. Give me some context. Looking at the Great Depression, looking at the Great Recession, and looking at now, which is an economic depression that's certainly not over. Give us some context. Is this, will this be the next or the newest Great Depression, or is it something that is sort of a blip on the economic radar in the grand scheme of things?
Well, you know, we're this is kind of a movie where we're still in the middle of it, and we don't know exactly how it ends. We know it got a very bad start. You know, for example, not every other country is facing 20% unemployment. So we know that the 2 months of denial and delay, you know, people talk about how many more lives could have been saved if in January we had gone into massive mobilization on testing and safety and masks. You know, how many lives would have been saved? Well, that's most important. But I will also say that we're going to realize that there were millions and millions of jobs, and I think millions of small businesses that will be lost that were unnecessarily lost. You know, we do have a lot of power. We're the United States. We have a lot of power to determine how we are going to do, even in a crisis like this. And we have to recognize that there are countries that acted more swiftly and may never see unemployment rise to even 10% as opposed to 20%. And again, some of it's been failure right in front of our eyes. We saw the small business program, the PPP, that had an elegant concept to it, which is if you're a small business and you're viable and you're just being hurt by this pandemic, we'll let you keep your workers on the payroll and we'll let you keep the lights on. And if you can show us that you're really hurt and you're using the money in the right way, we'll turn those loans into grants and we'll actually help keep you afloat. Not because you've done nothing wrong, and we don't want the business you might have spent 20 years creating, you know, sweat and blood, loans from family members. We don't want to see that destroyed for no reason at all. And yet we saw that program end up going to, who were the best bank customers, who were their concierge clients. And I think almost all of us in our lives know some small business that was viable. That's going to be lost forever, and those jobs are going to be lost forever. And it's heartbreaking, but we are where we are. We've got to do the bold things going forward. And I think that you know, this doesn't have to be partisan. I think Governor DeWine echoes, you know, some common sense about the state of states who had no capacity to predict a 1-in-102-year flood. And if we don't give those state and local governments aids, then we're going to be talking in 2 months from now about, you know, how many millions of teachers and state troopers and first responder jobs we lost that were unnecessary. So we can be bold, and we should be bold in a smart way. Let's keep afloat the families, the small businesses that have done nothing wrong and that could remain viable and could still be contributing and adding value to our economy when we're able to reopen in a safe and careful way that won't lead to a second wave or a backfire. So, you know, it is a very devastating crisis, and 20% unemployment, which I think will hit, is unthinkable. But I still want to say this is not something beyond our control. The existence of COVID was beyond our control. Whether it's a hard hit or a depression-like hit is in our control. We can affect what happens by the boldness and smartness of our public policies.
Gene, one more question, and then I'm sure you have other matters to tend to. You were the chief economic advisor to President Obama and to President Clinton, correct?
Yes, I was.
And so you were presumably part of the team that helped bring us back out of the Great Recession. So let's say that President Trump calls you today and says, Gene, what do we do? What do we do to come back from this? What is your advice?
I would say, Mr. President, stop running back and having a separate new bill with all the political back and forth every month or 2 months. Have a program that says, we, the United States, are going to continue with bold help to those who've lost their job. We're going to continue to help deserving small businesses. We're going to help states who've lost revenue of no fault of their own because of the shutdown and sheltering and social distancing orders. And I would say, let's just tie it to the state of the economy. And it will go as long as it's needed. But if we can recover faster, if we get a vaccine, if we can reopen smart and safe, that unemployment rate will go down. It will start going below 10%. And then you automatically continue that assistance when it's needed, but it automatically fades off when it's not needed. Then people would know that they're going to be able to pay their bills. Then small businesses would know they can keep the doors open. Then a governor or mayor will know they don't need to lay off teachers before the school year starts next year. I think we can provide that certainty. It's smart. It's automatically linked to the state of the economy. And it says to the American people, we're America. We're going to do whatever necessary to get through this because we care about our economy. But more important, we care about each other. We care about our people. That, I think, is the smart, sound policy, and I think it could be done. I'm just worried that this is starting to become an ideological football, a campaign issue, instead of what it should be, which is a more hard, evidence-based look at what our country needs and what the American people would like to see for workers, essential workers who are putting their lives on the line. They'd like to see them being treated well. I truly believe that. I truly believe that most people do not think it is a radical agenda to say that those workers should have a decent amount of pay, maybe some hazard pay, that they should have the paid sick leave to care for their own families, and that they should be treated with respect during this period. And people who work their whole life or worked hard to keep a small business going their whole life shouldn't see all their dreams destroyed just because they happen to be alive and working during a 102-year pandemic.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking with Gene Sterling, former director of the National Economic Council under President Barack Obama and President Bill Clinton, founder of the Center of Universal Education at the Brookings Institution, and author of the new book, Economic Dignity, which can be purchased wherever books are sold. Gene, thank you so much for speaking with me today, for your insight, and for the work you're doing to try to help rebuild a more compassionate economy.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you having me and being willing to talk about the ideas in the book and what's happening in our economy now. So thank you so much for including me.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.